The following podcast is for informational purposes only. The contents of this podcast do not constitute tax, legal, or investment advice. Take responsibility for your own decisions, consult with the proper professionals, and do your own research.
And taking responsibility for your own actions and your own acquisition of knowledge. And the graph community provides many ways for people to do that. So it's really on how much effort you're willing to put in. That's the real thrill of it. Everyone can participate.
Awesome. Thanks for letting me turn the mic on you. Thanks for being a good sport.
Sure. I'll cut it anyway. I'm joking. Welcome to the GRTIQ podcast. Today I'm doing something different. I'm speaking with a panel of guests on the topic of the recent migration of subgraphs to the mainnet. If you've spent any time on the Graphs Discord or in the forum, then my panelists will be familiar names: Martine, Slim Chance, Payne, and Jim Cousins. Each panelist represents an important stakeholder perspective and provides valuable insights listeners will find useful. The objective of our conversation was to take listeners inside the recent migration and address the most common questions about the migration and the future of the graph. We started the panel discussion by having each panelist introduce themselves.
Hi there, my name is Jim. I am a council member on the Graph Protocol. I'm also a part of the relations team in the Graph Foundation, specifically looking at indexer experience. And on top of that, I also run an indexer named Wave 5.
Hey, I'm Martin. I currently work at the Graph Foundation, doing ecosystem development and facilitating the growth of the community.
Hey, everyone. My name is Payne. I am part of the Foundation's indexer relations together with Jim. And a part of that, I also work on the QA and on the Explorer side of things with the Foundation and Edge and Node. And I also run, together with a friend of mine, we run Stake Squid, which is kind of a medium-sized indexer on the Graph network. We've been here since the beginning of the mission control testnet, since July last year, if I remember correctly.
And Slim Chance.
I work with the curator relations for the Graph Foundation, and my role is to empower curators with the documentation, support, and tools they need to succeed. I also act as one of the domain experts in the grant process.
Awesome. Well, welcome to each of you, and thank you for joining this panel discussion as we take a look at the first 10 subgraph migrations and provide listeners with some insight as to all the things that happened and continue to happen in relationship to this important event. So I think it's important to set the context for where we are in the roadmap and everything that's happening at the graph and what this recent migration of these 10 subgraphs represents. So kind of setting the context, maybe I'll go to you, Martin. How should listeners think about where we're at in the evolution of the graph and how the first 10 subgraph migration fits in?
That's a great question. I think we're right in the middle of a huge process. So if we take a step back, we have to remember that the hosted service has been around for a couple of years. There's already like thousands of subgraphs deployed. And even if I recall correctly, during April, it processed over 20 billion queries. And then on a similar track, like the network launched at the end of last year, and the community did the first step, which was bootstrapping indexing supply. And now we've seen these first 10 subgraphs migrating, which seems like an obvious next step. But this includes a lot of work by indexing community, and it's building the muscle for the next thousands of subgraphs migrating. So when you have all of this, or you take all of this into account, you take this bird view, and there's so much more coming. Thousands of subgraphs are migrating soon to the network, and they will allow applications to become fully decentralized thanks to the graph network. This will change everything, at least in my mind, because it's not only how the community organizes itself that will change, because we'll see new relationships between indexers and curators, which let us remember that that includes StackCraft developers. But more importantly, how people rethink the stack of applications will change. Data will be organized, indexed, and provided to anyone in a permissionless way. And that will change the way people think about data itself.
So, Jim, what's the best way then to describe this migration for people that may not understand it and its significance?
Sure. So I guess, just to step back for a minute and just think about what is the migration? What are we talking about when we say migration? Currently, we have the hosted version of the graph, which is a centralized, large infrastructure that lives in the cloud and serves data to dApps today and hosts all of the subgraphs, all 9,000 plus subgraphs, and provides data layer to dApps for free. And running alongside that, we have our new decentralized graph protocol mainnet. And this is where all the indexers live. This is where all the delegators live. This is where the curators live. This is where the subgraph developers eventually will live too, although they'll be living between two worlds for a while. So the centralized service, by the very definition of the word centralized, is one service, right? When we move, or as we move or migrate, as is the word we're using here, we migrate from this centralized service where the subgraphs are being served by one very large, essentially indexing infrastructure, to the indexers on the graph protocol mainnet, of which there are about 170 right now. And those 170 indexers, over the period of the migration, will start to take on the responsibility for delivering the data, the queries to those dApps, and it will be in a evidently much more decentralized manner. So we'll have 172 indexers in theory with today's statistics providing data services to dApps. So why is this important, right? This is incredibly important, right? We often talk about decentralization and, some projects are on one end of the decentralization spectrum where it's more like theater and they aren't really doing decentralization. And then you have other projects that are sort of maximalists when it comes to decentralization and they want their data to be as decentralized as possible, right? And for most of the people that are involved with the graph protocol, we believe that a data layer needs to be as maximally decentralized as possible. And that's why the vision of the graph network is coming into fruition today. So its significance is that we're moving from this centralized hosted service to 172 indexers delivering the subgraph data in a fully decentralized way to all of the dApps that are out there and like to use the graph today.
Anybody else want to add in on that?
To double down on why decentralization is so important is because it's permissionless, censorship resistant, robust, secure, and also naturally load balanced. And that will be extremely important going forward for dApps that wish to have a truly decentralized infrastructure.
I thought it might be interesting to start with this question for the panel about something you learned new or something that surprised you as a result of the first 10 subgraph migrations. And so maybe I'll go back to you, Jim. What was it that you learned either about the community or about the protocol itself following the first migration?
Well, with very large projects, you'll often hear aphorisms and sort of common sense quotes about the fact that, things will always go wrong. There will always be something that goes wrong with large projects. And somehow once you're in the midst of a very large project, you tend to forget that. And you think that, you've written your plan out and that's how it's going to go. But the reality of, over the last few months, moving from testnet, where we've been testing, very high query per second load testing on into mainnet, what we found is that there's various different unexpected challenges that you come up against on a project of this size. And the interesting thing to me is the way that the community has kind of rallied around these problems, because we're talking about pretty complex problems. For example, one of the 10 migration partners that was deployed had what we call a fatal error on one of their subgraphs while the indexers were syncing it. And what this meant was that the subgraph could no longer be indexed. What usually happens in that situation is that the developer will fix that, deploy it as a new subgraph. But now that we have money involved in the network, we have value involved in the network in the form of GRT, what we find is that indexers actually end up getting punished in, you know, rare situations like that. So the community has been realizing now over the last couple of weeks that it's, you know, although we have all the theory in place as for the mechanism, there are going to be things that need to change over time. And, you know, the interesting thing to me is it has been seeing the community rally around that and making noise in the right places to fix things. So, for example, this fatal error incident that I've talked about has already been integrated into the charter. The charter is how we police indexers and the integrity of their data and their queries. So we've already integrated this incident into the charter so that if it happens again, then indexers will not be punished financially for that. That's the most interesting thing that I've seen in the last, 2 weeks.
I'd like to open it up. Do any of the others of you have something that interested you or surprised you during this process?
Well, like Jim said, it's never easy. You should always expect some trouble, but the most important is to have everyone around you and support and move forward with whatever happens and try to improve things over time. But I also want to take this chance to give a shout out to the office hours, because that's where most of these discussions started. And basically, we chatted every week around these migrations troubles that we had. And people are getting more and more involved as of lately, because now they have actual work to do, not just have one single subgraph to index. There's multiple subgraphs, there's queries involved now, they have to scale up their infrastructure. Everything contributed to more activity and more involvement. And it's really a nice thing to see in the community.
Can I ask you a question then, Payne? So from your perspective as somebody who runs multiple indexers, as you know, sort of pertaining to that subject specifically, is there anything that you've seen that's been interesting, gas efficiency or performance issues or anything like that, that would sort of pertain to having such a large scale operation?
Yeah, gas costs were definitely a lot higher at some point. And we didn't, luckily, we didn't have to rebalance anything, because more or less we were earning kind of the same returns. But the biggest trouble I run into was the fact that Enzyme subgraph basically blew up for me on 5 different machines before everyone else's did. And I basically just went on a troubleshooting session with Ford and Leo from Edge and Node. And we kind of find out that TurboGeth is having some trouble in the way they read the blocks from the chain. So their implementation of, if you remember correctly, we had this environment variable in the graph node to call by number to have it disabled, right? And all the calls should be made by hash. Like in this situation, TurboGeth, for example, calls by number and then converts by hash. So there's a big problem. We didn't know about this. Every single week, there's something new to learn and something new to adapt to and something new to overcome. Like even with our 5 indexes, we were having trouble with Omen syncing very slow, and we had to import the database from someone in order to even close the allocations. It was quite a challenge to import 400 gigs of non-optimized database dump into 5 servers. But yeah, that's already over. And I also learned something from that, the way you should do your backups in a certain way to avoid these kind of things.
I think one of the questions that listeners have is about these partners that were the first 10 subgraphs to move over, and how important those partners have been early on here.
They were definitely super important. As you were saying, there was this issue that arise with the Enzyme subgraph. And it becomes important that their developer is active and knows the community. We've definitely seen everyone super active, as we have over 10,000 subgraph developers working on the ecosystem. But the way, in this case, but the main developer behind this Enzyme subgraph jumped into the indexer conversations when the subgraph broke, definitely made a huge impact on how the challenge was solved. I think that's the main takeaway from the importance of them.
How has the experience with these first 10, how will that inform future migrations and the way people should think about or what they've learned from it?
I think it's informing everyone in the community of different aspects. One, definitely the subgraph developers need to be involved. As we mentioned before, in the case of the enzyme subgraph, but also the aspect of the human coordination of not every indexer is always online, because we live in a world where there's always somebody sleeping. So everything takes time, and you can account for that. But always when you see that happening and see how long it takes, I think Jim was mentioning even before, like many of them have already upgraded, but not necessarily all of them. And learning about that human coordination is also crucial for the successful of the network.
Anybody else have an opinion on that?
Yeah. So when I think about the things I've learned over the first migration period, it relates back to, you know, the unexpected challenges that you come up against. And I think as a, you know, everybody on here is a leader within the community. And the thing that I learned, I think, was that when you have these potentially very complex issues come up, and you're trying to discuss them with the community, the sooner you can get your thoughts to paper, the sooner there can, you know, resolution can be found. That's been my experience over the last couple of weeks as we've dealt with this fatal subgraph error and how we will deal with it in the future. So getting your thoughts to paper so people can see them and read them as a whole piece of, you know, thought piece, I think for me is very important now as we go on and we face more challenges.
Yeah, I think Jim pointed out really well that those relations between the subgraph developers and the indexers will develop over time, and the community will be held strongly together by those relationships, because everyone will be helping each other to not make mistakes, because now mistakes will cost money and no one wants to pay money for stupid things like having your subgraphs blowing up, right? I mean, everyone learns. We indexers learned the hard way that what happens when a subgraph is failing. Developers also learned that it's not a good idea to punish them for these kind of things, depending on the scenario. So everyone is now working together to nail those things out and make it easier for future subgraph developers to have an easier life when they were going by and deploying their subgraphs to the mainnet.
I could add another learning is, maybe Jim or Payne can comment better of this, but I think one of the biggest learnings also on the indexer side was the difference of the indexers that were running Scala on the testnet. They definitely were able to test everything and saw it working, not only on the query side and seeing, you know, like I think 7,000 queries per second, but also how easy it was to upgrade. I think, Jim, you mentioned that it was the maturity of the software that you were experiencing as everything becomes easier to handle. Everyone that was on testnet was seeing that weeks before. And there's so much value of being active there that I think it can be measured in words, but definitely there's even some confidence when you're upgrading. It's like you've seen this working for weeks on your own infrastructure. So there's a lot of value and learnings there for sure.
Yeah, I think during migration, we saw the value of different stakeholders taking ownership of the network and coming together. Subgraph developers, indexers, and the graph core team solving not only technical issues, but also questions regarding governance.
From maybe the indexer perspective, how were indexers working with these particular 10 partners? Was there really close communication to make sure everything went well and was seamless, that they could give feedback in both directions? How should we think about what it was like behind the scenes with these particular 10?
Well, indexers didn't have much to discuss with those partners. We just saw the subgraphs being published and everyone took action on their own. Once stages of migration will end and then everyone will be able to publish their own subgraphs, there won't be any communications like, hey, guys, I'm about to publish a subgraph or anything like that. So you have to prepare for this and you have to be dynamic and you have to act on all the opportunities as you get.
Jim, what would you want to add?
I think we were very lucky in terms of, you know, there being eventually many thousands of subgraphs. We've gone in with our first 10 and, you know, shout out again to Fubi. Fubi, the developer of the enzyme subgraph, was, you know, the moment that things were going wrong and people were reporting issues in the Discord chat, Fubi was there answering questions and trying to figure out exactly what the issue was and then taking ownership of issues. And you really couldn't have asked for a better migration partner than that. Somebody who's proactive and wants to get involved in the process and already understands deeply how the subgraph development process works. They're the best people to get involved then in how planning and putting the structures in to make sure that once we're scaling up into the thousands of subgraphs, then we can overcome these sorts of problems we're having at scale, right? The reality is that subgraphs have fatal errors, you know, errors that stop us from indexing them. This is the nature of the beast as it stands today. It's going to happen again. So we need a framework in place to tackle that every time it comes along. And we're in the, you know, this is not something that was never thought of. It's always in the pipeline that we need a solid, relatively decentralized process to deal with this. It's just now we've got it for real. And to be honest, I've got a lot of confidence, given that the indexers obviously now have capital on the line. So they're very keen to make sure that anything that impacts their bottom line and the bottom line of their delegators is addressed quick. The subgraph developers, they also have, you know, economic interest here because they have to signal on their own subgraphs, which obviously cost them GRT. So all of this process is tied to real financial consequences now. So I'm quite confident that with developers like Fubi and with the indexer community and with the assistance and the guidance and the governance of the council, and also, you know, sort of the continuing guidance from Edge and Node and the wider community, we're going to find a way to manage this long term.
Slim, I want to ask you a question related to curators. You know, this is one of the things that particularly members of the delegator community are really interested in, to see more activity from curators and to see curation services turned on. And so what are you seeing within the curator community currently?
I see a lot of expectations of the upcoming curation launch. And if everything goes to plan, we will have curation going live in the coming 30 days. And at that point, we will have the curation UI and guides ready.
How important is that milestone for the graph community? I guess the question is, delegators are putting a lot of interest in curators and curation services. And maybe it's because a lot of them want to be involved in curation. But what's your opinion on that?
I think curation markets are going to be a cutting edge of crypto economic primitives in general. It has never been done at this scale and level of complexity before. Curators, they will have an integral role of actively assessing subgraphs. So I think it's very justified that people are excited about it, but it also carries a high risk, especially early on in the network, as nothing is settled and no kind of equilibrium is found yet. So I would say to delegators that are looking at curation to be excited, but also to do your research and be prepared.
Do any of you others have advice for members of the community and maybe delegators specifically who want to get involved as curator? And now that you have this new perspective, having seen these 10 subgraphs migrate, does that inform what advice you would give?
I guess two points of view. So from the sort of just, you know, I always talk about putting hats on, right? So put my curator hat on for a minute. So during the mission control, we did have a taste of what curation was like. And what I learned from that is that you need to be very, very cautious if you don't understand bonding curves correctly, because one of the main dynamics within the curation mechanism is this bonding curve for, you know, buying signal on a subgraph. Now, I'm not going to go into the dynamics of that in any detail because I find it quite complex myself, a lot of maths involved. But what I do know is that, you know, in the sort of crypto space, in the DeFi space, we have this concept of aping in, right? So you don't think about what you're doing, you just throw your money into something. What I know for a fact is that that's the worst possible thing you could ever do in a curation space where you have bonding curves, because you may end up taking out less than 1% of what you put in if you're trying to speculate. So, you know, from my own point of view, and I'm a pretty risk averse person, you know, if I was going into curation and I really did feel like I need to play the game from the beginning, then I would be playing with a very, very small percentage, like single digits of whatever my block of money is for curation, just to learn about it and be able to talk about it, you know, with some authority. So that's what I would recommend to delegators. Now, if you are a very risk-averse person, I think most delegators probably are, because the delegator role is kind of designed that way, right? If you're a very risk-averse person, just stand by and watch what happens. Pay attention to the curator channel and listen in to what's going on. Now, from the indexer perspective, there's also a perspective for the indexer when it comes to curation. So just to give you an idea of where indexes are right now, indexers have a couple of choices. Well, they have unlimited choices for strategy when it comes to allocating. But there's two main strategies that can be followed right now. One is allocation optimization. So what that means is that the indexer will take his stake and his delegator stake and he will allocate them so that they make the most GRT per hour per GRT allocated. That's what most indexers have been doing, if you follow things on chain, since migration started. Now that we're into the migration phase, for those that don't really look at the stats or the signals right now, just to give you an overview, it's very simple right now. So we have 10 subgraphs plus one old subgraph that was from the first testnet. And those 10 migration subgraphs have roughly the same signal on all of them. So what that really means is that indexers should be spreading their allocation out relatively evenly across all of those partners if they want to maximize their query fees. Some indexers are choosing to do that. Anyone that follows me on Twitter will know that I put out a sort of thesis on the migration for wave five, which is signal weighting. So I want to support as many subgraphs as I can during migration. Other indexers might not choose to do that. When curation comes along, and this is the important bit, those signals are going to change, right? So that's the thing to be watching out for, even as a delegator. Is your indexer following the signal, or are they doing something completely different? I have my own personal beliefs on which is the thing to do right now, but you know, some others might disagree with me and might be profit maximalists. But I would definitely, as a delegator, be paying attention to those things. The best places to pay attention to those things are graphscan.io. You know, if you can go in there and look at your indexer and see where they're allocating to and how many different subgraphs they're allocating to, how much they're allocating to each subgraph. And then there's also Stake Machines dashboard, which gives a sort of a more in-depth view of what's going on, both for you as a delegator and for your indexers. And I believe he also has, Slim, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he has curator dashboards in the works as well.
Yeah, at least he has it in the UI, so I believe so.
Yep, so that's coming as well. So that, I guess that's my two points of view on the curation side of things from an indexer point of view.
I would suggest for sure to go and read this month in curation and newsletters that Slim puts every month. Especially the first two editions cover a lot of risk and benefits and a lot of links to understand how bonding curve works. So you get all the learnings before the UI is ready to launch curation on mainnet.
I would also like to add to that Dave's presentation 10 minutes into the phase two workshop of the curator program. He goes through how to assess a subgraph. And it's a very good primer to understand how subgraphs work and how to determine if it's a good subgraph to curate.
Payne, do you want to add anything?
Not really, other than curation will be awesome. I can't wait to study the market dynamics and to see how everything changes whenever the signal on specific subgraphs change. Like, how would indexer react to that? There's a lot of things to put down on paper and visualize. Basically, it's going to be fantastic.
What did we learn about the indexer community as someone just watching? I saw different indexers respond in different ways. What's been the insight or anything we've learned about the indexer community itself following the migration? Jim, we'll start with you.
I guess as you know, working on the indexer relations or indexer experience side of things, one of my jobs is trying to make sure that when we have these big iterations, you know, these big software upgrades, we try and get as many people as possible onto those upgrades as soon as possible. And to be honest with you, I felt like probably the first 24 hours, I wasn't getting the response I was expecting to see in terms of getting indexers to upgrade to the version of the indexer software stack that sort of unlocked the main net transactions. But now I look in the, you know, where are we now? I think it was Tuesday, the 25th of May. I believe that's the day that 15.1 of the indexer stack came out, and the indexer chats are on fire. Everyone's getting upgraded. But what I have noticed, and it kind of plays back into this, I mentioned, you know, when talking about curation, signal weighted allocations, those, you know, dividing your allocations and your delegators' allocations across all of the migration partners. But, you know, if you take a look at network.thegraph.com, you can actually see how many indexers are sort of spreading their allocation out amongst all 10 subgraphs and who are not spreading them out. And, you know, there's a mix of things happening there. And what I would like to see is more people supporting more of the subgraphs for now, even if it means they're going to be making less profit per GRT allocated. So it's been interesting to see that gradual change. So I was going and looking at the numbers this morning, and for the first time, I noticed that we were almost optimally allocated across all subgraphs for the first time since migration started. For a long time, things were extremely unbalanced in terms of where our stake was being allocated, but now it's starting to even out across the partners. But I'm just hoping to see more of that as people are getting up to speed on mainnet. People are also getting up to speed on testnet to make sure that they can start testing the new things that come down the line, like Vector. We've got Scalar on mainnet, but Vector integration is still to come. I guess that's my initial observation.
I'm happy to see a lot more people being involved in all these discussions, especially during office hours. So we've been getting a lot more participation lately, and also in the chats, so outside of office hours. But yeah, it's amazing to see so many people wanting to like actively participate in the community and actively solve problems whenever they occur and actively be involved in the growth of the network. What else can I say? It's amazing.
I think your point there, Payne, about seeing more people participate is really important, because I feel like maybe for the first, you know, sometimes you feel a bit lonely as a leader or a, you know, assumed leader within a group, and you don't feel like there's new faces coming up to the surface that are sort of making the effort to contribute to the community. But now that we have money on the line, a value on the line, more leaders are starting to come to the forefront in the indexer space. And I expect the same thing. We're seeing the same thing happening in the delegator space. And I expect to see the same thing in the curator space as well. So I'm feeling very positive about that. Whereas, you know, in the sort of the long period of anticipation of moving from testnet to mainnet, I felt like things were dwindling in terms of indexer active participation. But I think it's really kicking off now. And we're seeing new names come to the forefront that are really, they're really contributing useful and valuable things to the community.
The GRTIQ podcast is made possible by a generous grant from the Graph Foundation. The Graph Grants program provides support for protocol infrastructure, tooling, dApps, subgraphs, and community building efforts. Learn more at thegraph.foundation. That's thegraph.foundation.
This is GRTIQ. Each week, we introduce listeners to different members of the Graph community and ecosystem. Our goal here is to engage listeners by telling the stories and sharing the insights of those helping to build the Graph. Please consider supporting this project by leaving a review wherever you listen to the podcast or by sharing your favorite episodes on social media. And don't forget to visit grtiq.com/podcast for detailed show notes. Thanks for listening. One thing that I noticed as just an observer about the indexer community following the migration was there was a bunch that seemed to leave. In other words, the total indexer number appeared to drop. Assuming my data is correct, were any of you surprised by that, or would that be something we would expect, kind of weeding out people that aren't participating or able to participate? Any thoughts on that?
I was planning to investigate exactly who those people were and why they decided to stop the indexer business operations. But one thing I could guess is the fact that if you have a medium to large size, but I don't think it's the case for those guys, but if you have a medium or large sized indexer, your expenses go up linearly. Like if you start allocating towards multiple subgraphs, you basically pay a lot more. That could be one of the factors. The other factor is that maybe they didn't want to bother to learn how the protocol works, you know, because until the migration started, we basically just had one subgraph. No matter how bad you were, you could technically do your job well. There was no performance KPIs present at that point. But now things changed and they probably just don't want to bother. I don't know.
With the network, you know, we talk about this all the time on office hours, Payne. We talk about the idea of network incentives, right? And how the network incentives for the network are going to change over time. So as things stand today, in terms of the GRT market, it's a delegator-driven market. And in terms of the network incentives, there is a bias right now towards the GRT that is earned via indexer rewards. And the ultimate is not an end goal, but maybe the steady state of the network is some sort of balance between the indexer rewards and the query fee rewards, right? And we're not there right now, and it's going to take time for us to grow into that space. So I also sometimes wonder if these indexers that fall off the grid are maybe falling off the grid because they don't see that happening soon enough. And maybe their stake is small enough that it's quite difficult for them to break even with the allocation they have.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, it was costing upwards of $400 per allocation, per action taken, per close and open, right? Yeah. And if you don't have at least, I think it was 1 million JUNT last time I calculated, you were basically breaking even at the first time you were closing and opening your allocations in a month. And like I said, I don't know exactly the details of who those people were and how big their stake was. But the gas prices also could have played a role here. Just wanted to point that out.
But it's also very clear, you know, from a more positive, you know, point of view on the number of indexers. There's a hardcore 20 indexers that, you know, are very active all the time and are the core contributors in the network. And some of them are the very biggest in terms of self-stake on the network or in total delegation on the network. And when times get hard and people start thinking about bear markets and stuff like that, those are the people that you look up and they're still around, right? They're the people that really believe in what we're doing here. And the tail end of it is just, to me, it's the natural ebb and flow of, you know, a living, breathing network. You know, you could maybe think of it in the same terms of, I don't know, ETH nodes going on and offline, right? People turn them on and off for various different reasons. I know there's not so much of an economic factor there, but it's the same idea. Like there's an ebb and flow of active indexers in the network. And we have seen new names come around as well. People that have graduated from the testnet and are now staking on mainnet, and they're fresh faces. They weren't on mission control. They just believe in the vision and they've put the capital to work to get involved as indexers.
To add there, I think it's also worth highlighting that even with these changes, as the network is maturing, which I believe is the nature of a live network, there won't be always the same amount of indexers. There won't be the same amount of, you know, participants in the different phases. But it's interesting that the total staked security remains at our all-time high, or around 27% of the supply. Yeah, 2.7 billion. So I believe that there's also a place where maybe it's because all the talks with regarding the arbitration charter and all the investigations that are happening around in mainnet currently, maybe they just stopped their indexer and are delegating. I mean, I haven't done the research on the specific addresses, but it's worth asking ourselves that, given that the current stake is on the highest part of what we have seen in the past 5 months.
That's a good point.
Anything to add there, Slim?
Well, in times like this, I think it's a great opportunity for delegators to learn more about the indexers who are proactive, participating in discussions and looking to learn. I don't think delegators should focus too much on query fees or the actual rewards, as Jim and Haynes touched on. It's not the most important right under during this migration phase, but instead how they act, who's still participating and learning, because everyone has something to learn, I believe.
Another question, and I feel like I need to ask it on behalf of all the delegators that regularly listen to the podcast. It seems like there was this potential red flag that an indexer was only in pool together following the migration. So it was like, when are they going to participate in these other subgraphs? But there are also the other side of this, which is there's indexers that have gone all in on one of the 10 new subgraphs. They're only in one of those. I guess the question is that a red flag too? Or does it make sense that indexers, as more subgraphs migrate over, might go all in on one particular subgraph? How should delegators think about that?
As Jim was talking earlier, it all depends on what your target is, if it's profit maximization or if you just want to serve queries for all the subgraphs, regardless of the indexer, like inflationary rewards, profit maximization, you know? But speaking from the point of view of profit maximization at that given moment when the subgraphs were added into the network and signaled upon, it would have made a lot more sense capital-wise to allocate to those new subgraphs, because it was, I don't know, a few days worth of time when those rewards were like literally double, triple compared to the old pool together. And some indexes just took their damn time. I mean, 7 days or even more in some cases. And they realize like, hey, something happened. And that's a side effect of not keeping your eye out on what the network is doing, you know? But to answer your specific question, it's not a bad thing if you see an indexer indexing only one subgraph from an economical perspective. I think we have two of our machines indexing only an enzyme, I believe, or some other subgraph. But in terms of how balanced it is from the rewards point of view, it's basically the same as if you were spreading to all the subgraphs based on signal.
What it really means is that an indexer is optimizing for profit, so indexer rewards, rather than query fees. I think I mentioned that earlier on. There's this kind of dynamic going on right now. And it's the nature of a network, right? So what these indexers that are sort of allocating to single subgraphs are doing is they're filling a gap where they can see an optimal GRT per hour, you know, can be earned. And they're sacrificing sort of the curation side of the network or the query fee side of the network in order to do that. Now, some would say that that's, or, you know, I think it's pretty a simple statement or agreeable statement to say that that is a rational thing to do if you're trying to maximize profit for your delegators. But is it necessarily the best thing to do for the network while it's bootstrapping? Maybe not. In my opinion, it's not the best thing to do. But, you know, every indexer has their own strategy and every delegator is, you know, has the right to question the strategy that an indexer has taken on.
Martin or Slim, do you want to add anything?
Every indexer has a specific set of context of how they operate. So some indexers are, you know, a two people operation, like Payne was saying in his introduction. Some others might be, you know, a huge company, which allows them to have a full-time employee and allows them to be closing allocations every day, for example. So that coupled with their strategy towards the network, it's going to be driving how many subgraphs they're going to be indexing, or even like how big is their infrastructure would probably direct how they will approach how many subgraphs they are indexing. So when instead of having 10, we have, you know, 100 or 1,000 subgraphs. Will all of them be indexing 1,000 subgraphs? Probably not. That's not necessarily, you know, a bad thing. Depends on, again, their infrastructure, how big is their operation from the human resources to us. It's intensive. You need to be paying attention to what's going on in the network, how to react to the network.
Recently, I had Zach Burns as a guest on the podcast and had him explain Scalar. He said, the network doesn't work without Scalar. What have we learned or what's happening with that as the migration occurred?
You know, I don't think it can be underestimated the leaps and bounds that have been made with the graph software over the last 6 months. For anybody who's sort of been close to the graph testnet and has watched the Edgenode team, Janice, Ord, and Zach especially, grinding away at this bleeding edge problem that we have in this space around micropayments, you know, at scale. To see that iterate over time, to see how difficult and how much trouble we had with it in the early days, and that would have been around epoch 90 on the network, right? 90-100 earlier than that. And now we're, you know, we're not a million miles away from epoch 200, and it's night and day. It's absolute night and day. So back in the early testnet, on my own indexer, I would struggle often to get into the tens of queries per second without having problems with the payment mechanism, the micropayment mechanism that we were using, state channels. If you compare that now to the Scalar implementation that was deployed in the smoothest manner you could possibly imagine from testnet to mainnet Tuesday, the 25th of May, you wouldn't believe the difference. It's night and day. On the testnet, I had two indexers running as test indexers at the same location. And between them, they were hitting. And this is test traffic, it's simulated traffic, right? So it's pretty light in terms of how much time it spends in the database. But I was hitting something in the region of over 2,000 queries per second, which is just, it's just, I couldn't believe it when I saw those numbers and I didn't see errors beside them. And that has gone on to the main net as well, right? And we used to have a list of about 100 errors, right, that are well-defined within the indexer software. And we used to have, you know, you'd have times where you'd have tens of thousands of them coming in every 5 minutes. But with the work that the guys have done on improving things and introducing Scalar, you know, what we're seeing on mainnet is a real product that is not suffering from those types of scaling issues that we were having before. It cannot be underestimated how much of an edge an indexer has by spending time on the testnet. A lot of indexers right now are chasing to get back onto the testnet because they've now realized this, having seen how smoothly things went on the mainnet launch on the 25th of May.
Payne, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, it's been crazy. Looking at the old mission control screenshots that I had, it's a difference, night and day difference here. But also, I wanted to point out that there was one more thing that also basically contributed to those errors not showing up anymore, Jim, is the fact that now indexers can sync up their own network subgraph. And basically that removes a lot of the dependence on the gateway itself.
Yep. So just to sort of explain that more in layman terms, prior to the last mainnet release, the indexers, they do this sort of polling communication onto there's basically a subgraph. We sort of use our own subgraph for the network. So there's one for the testnet, there's one for mainnet. And we use that subgraph in order to work out how things are going on the network, how our indexer is doing on the network, and making sure that the indexer software is making the right decisions at the right time. And what that resulted in was basically all these indexers are just hammering this gateway or this GraphQL endpoint all the time, in some ways committing a distributed denial of service attack, right? So flooding the gateway with traffic and requests to the point where it just can't handle the amount of requests that are coming in. So one of the major software upgrades that was made as part of the 0.15.1 deployment was they re-architected the software so that we could actually sync that subgraph, our own subgraph for the network, to our own indexer. So we no longer, once you have that subgraph indexed, you just query it yourself in your infrastructure, and you're no longer reliant on the network itself to answer those questions for you about how am I allocated on the network, all that type of stuff that the software needs to know in order to make decisions. So there's a huge upgrade.
And it's also cool that it has a failover system, like in case your subgraph falls behind chainhead or fails or God knows what happens, it will go back to the gateway subgraph and it adds more resilience to your entire machine and infrastructure.
Yeah, resilience is the word, right? That's what we see all the time. Incremental improvements in resilience so that the software performs better and we have less unexpected issues coming up. There's this constant stream of iteration. If you're familiar with GitHub, you'll see that, you know, the team are constantly working on new PRs to improve the software on a daily basis, and they're very receptive as well. Shout out to Ford from EdgeNode, who's always on the office hours as much as he can be, answering questions and also taking suggestions for ways to increase the resilience of the graph agent that we all use every day.
Let's talk about curators for a minute here. Slim, what advice do you have for members of the curator community that want to start getting more involved?
Well, curation does have quite a lot of risk associated with it. So I would advise to research curation carefully. I would start at this month in curation that you can find on the forums. And I would also look at the curator workshops from the testnet curator program. And especially I would look at Dave's presentation in the PACE 2 workshop, where he explains how to assess subgraphs.
Anybody else have an opinion on that?
Definitely jumping to learn the nuances of building subgraphs. So as Slim was saying, the workshop by Dave during the curator program last year is a great place to start learning how to assess schemas and learn which subgraphs are the ones that you want to curate. Will provide a good edge when curation is live. Also, I mentioned before, like this month in curation, newsletter by Slim provides a lot of value on how bonding curve works. And that's also something very important in that role. And I would say also become active in the Discord community. The Discord server of the graph is huge. I think it has over 22,000 people right now. And the curator, even if it's not live, they are jumping over, always asking like what's going on, what's the update, and learning about the different nuances. I'm sure like there's going to be a lot of rallying around as it happens in the office hours of the indexers. Like indexers gather around and discuss the different, you know, situations that are seen in the network. And the same is going to happen with curators. So the curators that are active and are learning as things go live and things happen and new subgrids are deployed are the ones that are going to become more knowledgeable.
It's a little nuanced, Martin, but does the advice change for subgraph developers? Is it the same advice for curators, or how would you, I guess, change your answer if we were speaking to subgraph developers?
Well, I see subgraph developers as curators, as they will need to signal on their subgraphs so indexers pick them up and start indexing them. I would say the difference there is like how technical that person is going to be. If you're already a subgraph developer, you already know how to write schemas and properly assess or assess more easily if there's other subgraphs that you want to curate, if they're like written properly and they're interesting for the community to be indexed by many indexers. If you're not that technical, that's where all these resources provided by Slim are super important. So again, starting from the bonding curve, so you start to learn how they work, and then the different risk and rewards of curation are great places where to start if you don't know a lot of how, you know, smart contracts works, bonding curve work, curation works in general. And that's going to be like the first step also to interact with indexers. Some of them probably are already delegators and already know which indexers are more active, or they trust more indexers. So when you see them more active on the community, that also provides a lot of information for them.
So turning the attention to indexers then, either new indexers or indexers that need to elevate their activity within the network, Payne and Jim, what's your advice to those members of the community?
So I guess it's pretty similar for new indexers and I guess seasoned indexers. The most important thing to do right now, if you're already on mainnet, is to make sure you're upgraded to 0.15.1 graph indexer stack. Now, if you're brand new and you're new to the network and you want to contribute and you know, at some point you might want to put the capital together to get on mainnet with yourself or with some others, the best place to start is get on Discord, get in the test GRT faucet and get some GRT for yourself and spin up a testnet indexer and start being active within the testnet channel on Discord. This is the way that you will improve your knowledge. This is the way that you will meet myself, Payne, Martin, the whole community. And this is the way that you'll get recognized if you are sort of a net positive contributor in that space. Attend the office hours on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Pacific. The purpose of that hour is to, originally it was to help indexers with their technical problems. That's still the purpose, but we also talk about sort of high level stuff there a lot of the time because it's a chance for indexers to get together every week. And then I would also suggest that, you know, if you're brand new to the graph, you want to look at some of the resources that are out there. There's the codex.thegraph.com, which is sort of like a curated list of links for all types of stuff on the graph. There's also the Graph Academy. That's the graph.academy, which is run by Stefan and is a great resource for all types of stakeholders, including indexers. There's some guides there for how to deploy on Docker and bare metal. And then, of course, also look at the main website because, you know, the core place that we used to send people before we expanded our sort of, you know, documentation was the blog, where you'll find some of the posts from one of the founders, Brandon, which will really help you understand the protocol at a fundamental level.
Yeah, definitely. Just be active in the community. Learn by doing and making mistakes on testnet, of course, before you jump onto mainnet. But just head into it and see what problems are you running into figure out ways to overcome them. This is how I learned, basically. I just experimented with things and just jumped straight into it. And whenever I had problems, I tried to solve them by myself. If I couldn't, I then searched the Discord. And then if I didn't find an answer there, I just ask there and people will gladly help you, you know. We're all here together to make things better at the end of the day. And it also helps the network. The more indexes, the better for the health of the network, you know. So you're more than welcome to just come and try and see how well you're doing. As for resources, definitely the Academy is basically the best place to get started. Easily. You can also use the official Graph Docs for setting up an indexer on Google Cloud with Terraform and Kubernetes. But I feel like Jim's guide and our StakeSquid guide are easier for someone that just is getting just started. I mean, you can ask Martin how hard it was to set it up. Like, it was fairly easy.
Definitely. This, at least the Docker guide by the stake squid is super easy.
Yeah, so it doesn't even take that many resources either. You can run it on, like, I don't know, an 8 or 4 core machine just to get the feel for it, right? You know, you can basically get those machines for, like, I don't know, less than 30 euros a month in some places. Again, just to get the feel for it, but it's not going to be enough for production. I mean, also depends on how big your stake is. But yeah, I mean, it's easy to get started. You just hit the faucet. You first get the roll. You can just, there's a channel called Rolls in the graph section in the Discord. You get the roll, you hit the faucet with your Ethereum address, and then you follow the guides on the Academy, and then you should be good to go within, I don't know, 1 hour at most, if you don't have any clue what you're doing.
I also want to give every member of the panel here the opportunity to give advice to another stakeholder within the community, and that's members of the Delegator community. So maybe going around and giving everybody the opportunity to give some advice to delegators. Let's start with you, Martin.
For new delegators, of course, it's jumping into the community. And there's a specific video by Brandon that is very insightful on how to choose your indexer. I would say start there. On the existing or current delegators in the network, I think it's worth checking in with your indexer. As you were asking before, there's this question of, like, if this is a red flag, if they are not indexing all the subgraphs. And as I was saying before, it's not a red flag, but it's worth checking in with them to see and understand, because this is the opportunity for you to get closer to your indexer and know what's their approach or strategy to the network. I think definitely that's the main opportunity in this phase of the migration.
I would recommend putting some thoughts into who you choose to delegate to. Your GRT is safe, but there's a 0.5% delegation tax. And if you were to undelegate your stake, it has a thawing period of 28 days. So I would make sure that to put some thought into what indexer you delegate to. For myself, I looked at criteria like communicative, skilled, aligned with the ecosystem, and having low yet sustainable cuts. If feasible, look into splitting your delegation stack between multiple indexers. And yeah, as Martin says, contact your indexer or your potential indexer if there's something you are wondering about. And please join the Discord community if you have any questions.
Just look for indexes that are active in the community and know what they're doing, because this is a way to, like, have a certainty that that indexer will sustain their business and will sustain their rewards generation. And you're basically maximizing your profits over time. Like, if you just go randomly spray and pray on 3 random indexers on GraphScan, for example, sorted by APY, you're not going to do well. Even if those APYs are high, it doesn't even mean they're performing good. Most of the time, they just give out their own rewards as indexers to the delegators to attract more delegators, which is not a bad thing in it by itself. But that's temporary, right? And you have to make sure that at the end of the day, at the end of the month, at the end of the year, you're with someone that you can trust to do their best always at every single moment in time to get those rewards, right? And those queries. And yeah, I mean, the only way to do it is by going with someone that is active in the community.
I think the guys have done a great job of answering that question. The only thing I would add is both for new delegators and existing delegators looking to maybe make changes to their delegations is to be cognizant of gas costs and how much it's going to, you know, the transaction to, you know, delegate to a delegator is going to cost you versus how much GRT you are delegating to them. There's a great website called gasnow.org, which you can go to look at the current prices of gas on Ethereum, and I would strongly recommend that before you make any press any buttons on your favorite wallet to delegate, check out the gas prices and only do it when the gas prices are relatively low.
You can also go to oracleminer.com/graph, and if you click on any of the indexers and you scroll down, you'll have a table of how much it costs to delegate, undelegate, and for indexers also open allocation and close allocation.
Hi, this is Tim Chance. I work with Curator Relations and act as a domain expert for the Graph Foundation. If this panel discussion with the GRT IQ podcast has been helpful to you, then please consider supporting future episodes by becoming a subscriber. Visit grtiq.com/podcast for more information. That's grtiq.com/podcast. Thanks for listening.
A follow-up question then for advice to delegators would be this question about what should delegators expect to see in terms of the query fees? Maybe I'll go to you with that, Jim, but what would be your advice to delegators regarding that?
One thing that we haven't really talked about is the actual content of the queries that we have on mainnet right now. So we have a mix right now of the actual migration partners themselves and stress testing from the Edge and Node team across all of those subgraphs. So there's a mix of simulated queries and real queries, depending on, you know, whether the migration partners have decided to start testing on their subgraphs or not. So it's difficult now to sort of start judging the amount of query revenue that is being generated. And there's a, you know, one of the reasons for that is what I've just described, right? So all of that traffic is paid for via GRT, via the micropayments, via Scalar. However, you also have to consider that part of the mechanism of the network where indexers get paid for these queries is they have to make these settlement transactions onto the Ethereum network. And many indexers will avoid doing that because where we're at with the network today, for example, the sort of traffic we're seeing right now, the amount of GRT and query fees that an indexer is making might be less than the cost in gases to take in or claw back that query revenue that they've generated via serving queries. So if you were to look at, for example, you mentioned there network.thegraph.com. On that dashboard, there is a section there on query fees, and you'll see per epoch how much query fee was claimed in that period. So it's very important to know that that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what was served. There will likely be much more than that served in the period, but the indexers haven't necessarily chosen to claim it yet because the amount that they'd be claiming is too small versus the gas it would cost them. So they're just being efficient about how they claim those fees. So the reason I kind of bring this up is because I think it's too early to start judging indexers by their query fee performance today. You will see that number start to increase, I think, over time, that GRT number per epoch. But on an individual basis, it's too early to start, you know, ranking indexers by the amount of query fees they're bringing in. So I think it's important to, you know, as we move through migration, that's going to continue to be the case until we sort of get to the very large scale of having thousands of subgraphs on the network.
Jim, what would be your advice to anybody that's just getting involved or starting to learn about the graph and hasn't really participated as a stakeholder at this point?
Sure. I mean, first thing is to sort of get a basic understanding of it from the top level. And the source I like to send people to is a YouTube channel called Finematics, Finematics. They do an excellent job of illustrating various blockchains and DeFi principles. And if you search their channel, you'll find one for the graph protocol. And it does a very good job of laying out to you how the different stakeholders play with each other within the protocol. Once you've had a look at that, my next recommendation is always to go and have a look at the graph.com. Specifically, it's nice to look at the blog section because Brandon, one of the founders, is, you know, his blog posts have been sort of the linchpin for education from the very beginning with the graph. So if you want to get into the detail, it's right there. You can also have a look at the Graph Explorer there, where you can see the wide array of subgraphs that are available. And finally, I would also strongly recommend that people go and have a look at the graph.academy. It's a very rich environment with lots of documentation for all the stakeholders created by one of the community members, Stefan. And it's a really great place to start. It's lots of visual documentation around how things work and gets a lot of great feedback from the community. Those are the things I would recommend.
Anybody else have an opinion on that?
I would love to recommend the recording of the Graph Day keynote by Yaniv. It gives an excellent presentation of our vision and what the protocol does from a very zoomed out perspective.
I would add to join the community in any way that you think viable or possible. The first step is basically jumping in one of our community channels in probably Discord server or Telegram, but I definitely feel from the communities that everyone is very welcoming. It's not just somebody answering questions. It's everyone helping everyone. And that's the best place to learn even or get directions if you don't understand a specific concept, besides after reading all the links or content that were provided here by Jim or Slim.
Yeah, this was one of the things that attracted me to the graph that much, the community, you know? Like everyone was just helping each other and it was such a nice feeling place. Like, I don't know how to call it. It was just unique. I didn't find any other project with a tighter community than the graph. And also, like during the testnet, everyone from the team even was very active and actively helping us because, well, it was the testnet and we needed guidance. But now that we have people that know what they're doing and they're domain experts for different parts of the ecosystem, they are now helping and they are now in charge of this and everything is just super organized and everyone is, yeah, the community is great. This is what I'm trying to get to. Like the community is absolutely amazing. And I think being active in the community is the easiest way to learn things. You just read the blog posts, like Jim said. And if you have any more questions, just go into any channel that you feel it's appropriate to ask your question and then ask your question because you will get answers.
So Payne mentions the strength of the community being such an important factor at the graph. And some cool community efforts involve things like the Graph Grants Program. Martin, maybe going to you, but what can you say about the Graph Grants Program?
That's a great question. So the Graph Grants Program was kickstarted a couple of months ago. It definitely got a lot of attention and got over several hundred publications. And that has enabled a lot of support in different ways to different entities or people working across the ecosystem and empower them to tackle different challenges. So from there, we've seen protocol infrastructure work on automation or abstractions, but also tooling on different like monitoring and alerts, the different dashboards like GraphQL, Graphlets, Grafana dashboards, even bots that have been or are currently worked on to empower more the community. So that's where a huge impact from the foundation is through the grants program, as it's enabling a lot of innovation across the different aspects. Along the tooling and the protocol infrastructure, there's a lot of work on subgraphs. There's more data that needs to be organized and indexed, and also community building. So Payne was mentioning great examples are like the Graph Academy that was mentioned a couple of times, but also there's online education programs, all the Graph Transit community, that is also a huge one, even including this podcast. And I think there's also more to come. A good one that happened recently was the PoApp grant. And so they created over 20,000 NFTs to reward the different active participants in the network. And that's definitely something that the Grid Foundation has been focused during the last couple of months.
I think the interesting thing for me is sort of observing this is to see some of these Wave 1 grant applicants take their products right into fruition, right? So the Graph Academy gets mentioned a lot, right? And there's a reason for that, right? It's very high quality. It's very well executed. And it has a real impact on the education for all stakeholders. And it has a real impact on how much impact one person on Discord can have in helping people, right? So it used to be that you would go as a community member on Discord who helps people, you'd spend quite a lot of time doing repetitive stuff where you'd be repeating the same, answering the same questions like, where do I start? How do I choose who to delegate to? If I have this certain problem, what do I do? And you spend all your time doing that, you know? But with resources like the Graph Academy, you're now referencing some high quality material elsewhere and a person can take themselves on that journey, right? To decide, you know, maybe what they want to do in the network or what they want to learn about the network. So we already feel the tangible benefits of Wave 1. That's just one example. The Pope is another great example. I love Popes. I'm addicted to Popes for some reason. They're just NFTs, right? But they represent something, especially in a community that's so rich like the Graph and has such a rich history now. The NFTs, they really mean something to me. And, you know, the fact that so much effort has gone into the design of them, so much effort has gone into actually executing the program, these are all things that have been funded by the community via the foundation. And we're only going to see more and more of that. you know, I get to do interviews as a domain expert where I interview grantees, and the stuff I see is just awesome. You see lots and lots of really cool stuff. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to see what comes out of wave two.
What I saw from those grants was people that love the graph now took advantage of these and started building and getting paid for building things. And everything is just going amazingly well. Like Jim said, the academy is absolutely fantastic. Everyone loves it. This podcast, everyone loves it. And I know there's a bunch of other tools that are being built right now, and I see everyone using them every single day. And I think once they get to release the updates and all that sort of stuff for these new tools, they're going to be even more amazing than they are. And most importantly, for the indexing side, is the fact that TurboGeth now supports Trace, kind of. We still have to nail things out on it, but I think that's the biggest impactful change in the lives of all the indexers. I'm talking only specifically about this stakeholder group, but that's one of the biggest things that happened thus far. And we're making sure that it will go well from this point onwards as well.
Yeah, working as a domain expert for the grant process, I've noticed that not only do we have hundreds of applicants, we have hundreds of really high quality applicants that have dedication and are aligned with the ecosystem. Yeah, I'm excited to see what wave two will bring.
So I'm interested in sort of your perspective as you've been doing the GRT IQ podcast. So how many months have you been doing this podcast for now?
Well, it's been since March 26th.
March. Wow. It feels much longer than that. So, I mean, I'd be interested to know what your experience has been in terms of interacting with the community, both through your podcast and then also Twitter and maybe Discord. What's your experience been as a guy who started with, I guess, limited knowledge and has now had the chance to talk to all these different community members?
I think my experience has been, first, meeting members of the community has been the thrill of it. So I didn't really know what the value of the podcast would be, other than I was a curious person who wanted to understand the graph better. And I thought the best way to obtain that knowledge would be to speak with different members of the community. And the podcast grew out of that. But what I found is that, you know, I now have friends all across the world, and the community is so strong, and it's like-minded people who are really for the community. So I think the thing that I've learned first and foremost is there are real people with genuine interests and motivations to help build the graph behind all of the activities you're seeing. And even though the push is towards decentralization and the push is towards DeFi and all these other really great things in the crypto space, it's still just people getting up every day and doing hard work. And so for me, running GRTIQ podcast, been the opportunity to meet these people and tell their stories. And that's been the thrill. The other thing I would just add is that there is a real hunger in the community among delegators, particularly, for more knowledge and understanding. And the graph is complicated and it is technical, but with the, you know, right approach, anyone can pick it up and understand it. And there's a lot of people that are interested in doing so. I'm tremendously humbled that the podcast is just one channel by which people are able to do that. But as has been mentioned many times today, the Graph Academy is an incredible resource for anybody who wants to take a self-directed approach. The Graph's official blog, getting on Discord, Telegram, all of these different channels provide easy access to get the information you want. And so part of the mantra of a decentralized world is self-responsibility and taking responsibility for your own actions and your own acquisition of knowledge. And the graph community provides many ways for people to do that. So it's really on how much effort you're willing to put in. That's the real thrill of it. Everyone can participate.
Awesome. Thanks for letting me turn the mic on you. Thanks for being a good sport.
Sure. I'll cut it anyway. I'm joking, Jim. Guys, thank you so much for joining this panel and taking part in helping educate members of the community. As we continue to move through different phases of the migration, would you all come back and we can have another panel discussion?
Glad to.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been a production of the GRT IQ podcast. You can find additional information, including detailed show notes, by visiting grtiq.com/podcast. That's grtiq.com/podcast.
Please consider contributing to this project and helping build the community by subscribing and leaving a review.
GRT.